This is VK6 Amateur Radio News with News West for Sunday the 20th of January 2021. Today is the history edition of News West. What's a mulgophone? And how do you test nighttime radio signal fade with two kerosene lanterns? Stay tuned and you'll find out. A few of our history items today are in support of the VK90 ABC special call sign, marking the 90th anniversary of the ABC, and we're bringing stories of early amateurs in Western Australia and their links to and involvement with the early days of the development of broadcast stations in this state. And there's another special event call sign coming up, VK80LAN, which is part of an international activation, and we remind you of that one, and it's being coordinated by VK6 locals. Mac, VK6 Mike brings us a story of his early transition into transistors. And we remind you of the PARG swap meet next weekend. Roy regales us with the amateur radio helpline, very likely the oldest continuing segment in Australian amateur radio news, maybe worldwide, who'd know? So stand by for a bumper history edition of amateur radio news.
We're devoting some time in this history edition of News West during the Australian Broadcasting Commission's 90th anniversary year to talk about Wally Coxon, VK6AGSK, who played a pivotal role in setting up and running the first commercial broadcast station in Western Australia. 6WF was originally owned by Westralian Farmers Cooperative and operated from a studio in the Westralian Farmers Building in Perth. 6WF transmitted its first broadcast on Wednesday, the 4th of June, 1924. In common with other early broadcasters, the engineering staff at 6WF were concerned about unreliable nighttime reception, with broadcast signals subject at times to fading and or distortion every few minutes beyond 50 to 100 miles, that's 80 to 180 kilometres now, from the transmitter. Depending on the season, prevailing conditions and transmission wavelength, such effects could limit the dependable nighttime range of medium wave stations, in particular to less than their daytime coverage. Keen to collect and correlate data in their own environment, Wally says that 6WF staff organised two transportable listening centres, which could be set up typically 300 yards apart in any available level field. By way of communication, both teams were equipped with a hurricane lamp, which could be turned up or down in brightness as the signal strength varied. Although primitive, the method was sufficiently effective to confirm that there was a significant time difference in the fading cycles as observed at the two sites. When the signal was poor at one, it would often be good at the other, an observation that gives rise to the concept of diversity reception. Wally left 6WF when the Australian Broadcasting Company purchased the station and went on to establish 6BY in Bunbury and 6AM in Northam, and then was involved with the Royal Flying Doctor Service in Western Australia, involving the equipping the RFDS with radios and building their radio network. Wally died in 1968 and was still licensed as VK6 Alpha Golf at the time.
Hi everyone, this is Mark Dixon, VK6 Echo Zulu from the West Australian VHF Group. Next month, for all of March, we're coordinating QSOs from VK80LAN, that's Victor Kilo 80 Lima Alpha November. It's a commemorative call sign issued to recognise the 80 years since the Avro Lancaster aircraft participated in Allied Air Force engagements in World War II, and you could be part of this celebration too. All the details are on QRZ for VK80LAN, that's qrz.com/lookup/VK80LAN. I'll mention that again at the end of this news item. The Lancaster was manufactured by the British aircraft manufacturer Avro. It's a four-engined heavy bomber adopted by UK's Royal Air Force during the Second World War, with substantial participation from the Canadian Air Force and Australia's RAAF. Some Lancaster aircraft still exist. There's one here in WA at the RAFA, that's R-A-A-F-A, Aviation Heritage Museum in Bull Creek, and there's another one in the Australian War Museum in Canberra. There's also some in Canada in the UK. This commemorative event for Lancaster aircraft is being simultaneously partnered in the UK by GB80LAN and in Canada by callsign VE80LAN. This event's ably supported here in West Australia by Reg Bagshaw, VK8BQQ, and his Flying Pignet, which you can hear on air each week. We're working to have the Australian part of the celebration launched at 0800 UTC from inside the Lancaster at the RAAFA Museum in Bull Creek. If you'd like to host VK80LAN during its operation in March, look for an available space on the schedule on the WAVHF Group website, then contact the coordinators for the event to request the time, band, mode that you'd like to host. QSLs will be ably supported by Tim Beaumont, M0URX, and his United Radio QSL Management Bureau. Questions and comments on this can be sent to Dennis Brown, VK6AKR, Robert McAtia, VK6WHO, or Mark Dixon, VK6EZ, at the West Australian VHF Group. Once again, details of the event and how to participate are at QRZ, that's http://qrz.com/lookup/VK80LAN. 73 is from me, Mark, VK6 Echo Zulu. I hope to catch you on air in March from VK80LAN.
The Peel Amateur Radio Group in Mandurah, Western Australia, is very pleased to announce that this year's swap meet will be held on Saturday, the 26th of February. The event will be held at the Mandurah Bowling Club at 89 Allnut Street in Mandurah. Doors open at 8 a.m. for exhibitors and sellers, of course, and 9 a.m. to 12:30 for buyers. Entry fee is only $5 a person. And we've got some great raffle prizes this year once again. So huge thanks to Future Systems and TET Emtron, both West Australian companies, and also Think Technology in Yass, New South Wales. We're offering prizes of an ICOM IC2300, an SDR receiver, a heavy-duty 30-amp power supply, a TET Emtron multi-band antenna, a vector network analyzer, and other prizes. So put it in your diary and plan to head on down to the Mandurah Bowling Club. It's only a 51-minute train ride from Perth and a 3-minute walk from the station to the Mandurah Bowling Club. And like everything, there's always a risk of COVID affecting the event, so check the Peel Amateur Radio Group website, www.parg.org.au, before the event. So once again, Saturday the 26th of February at the Mandurah Bowling Club, 89 Allnut Street in Mandurah, Western Australia. We look forward to meeting you on the day. This is Mark, VK6QI, on behalf of the Peel Amateur Radio Group.
This is VK6ARN, and you're listening to News West.
The Mulgaphone Wireless was introduced by Westralian Farmers Limited in 1924. It was a means by which farmers could listen in to radio station 6WF, which was established in Perth by the company. Mulga is Australian slang for the bush, or outback. The Mulgaphone sets were assembled and tested by Mr. Wally Coxon. He was probably West Australia's leading radio engineer at the time. He also played a key role in the establishment of 6WF, which officially opened on June the 4th, 1924. Wally was an amateur radio operator, call sign VK6 Alpha Golf. The initial batch of Mulgaphones were sealed sets with fixed coils and a tuning condenser that gave limited coverage of the radio spectrum. Their reception was centred on 6WF, the sole local station whose wavelength was 1,250 metres. The transmitter for 6WF was located on the Australian Farmers Limited building in Wellington Street, Perth, with the studios on the top floor of that building. Within the first month of operation, the sealed set system was abandoned by the government and the Mulgaphones were redesigned first with tapped internal coils and then with plug-in coils, usually basket weave or honeycomb time. This made it possible to tune to other wavelengths in the range 250 to 2,000 metres. Often, eastern state stations could be received at night. Mulgaphones could be purchased in a number of different forms. A Mulgaphone amplifier could also be purchased in order to use a horn speaker with the receiver instead of headphones. A shortwave Mulgaphone was also marketed in 1928 for the reception of 6WF transmissions on 104.5 metres. It is likely that the last Mulgaphones were manufactured in 1929. It is estimated that about 1,200 Mulgaphones were manufactured in Western Australia. Acknowledging randommuseum.org for the text.
This story comes from the Daily News in Perth, 16th of July 1928. Broadcast Listener by Chris T.L. Amateur Tests, Next Sunday's Experiments. The WA Division of the Australian Radio Transmitters, a recently formed organisation, has decided to hold another test message transmission on Sunday, July the 22nd. And because of the undependable weather prevailing, the transmitters will be operated from their owners' homes on a wavelength of 90 metres instead of in the country. Messages will be sent only between 2:30 p.m. and 5 p.m. and each message will consist of a number, origin time, address, text of not less than 5 words and signature. Only one message is to be sent to any station at each QSO, it being necessary to transmit a message to a different station before another may be sent. A system of points has been arranged for awarding to the various transmissions. A number of amateur transmitters have notified their intention of carrying out telephony tests on Sundays between 7:30 p.m. and 9 p.m.
It doesn't matter much if you love them or hate them. Special call sign activations are popular amongst amateur radio operators around the globe, whether or not you like them. So bear with me a little while I remind you about one that's only been going for a couple of weeks and has worked close to 70 different countries on CW, voice and digital modes. The Australian Broadcasting Corporation, the ABC, and amateur radio have a lot in common. Both utilise the magic of radio. For the last 90 years, this magic has informed, entertained, saved lives and brought people together. Our world is a smaller place thanks to the magic of radio. During 2022, amateur radio operators across Australia are using the special event call sign VK90ABC to make contact with other amateur radio operators across Australia and indeed around the world. We'll be talking about the national broadcaster, its history, and helping Auntie celebrate this magnificent milestone. And if you listen to ABC radio and television, they're starting to talk about it now. There's already been a successful ABC radio interview with Paul, VK5PAS, and more interviews are planned around the country. The call sign is VK90ABC. The website is vk90abc.net. And if you can't remember the web address, go to qrz.com and look up VK90ABC. Go on. You know you want to.
Henry Trethowan, known as Harry Simmons, was born in Western Australia in 1905. In February 1920, at the tender age of 14, he passed his public service examination as a telegraph messenger and was soon appointed to that position in the Postmaster General's department. The following year, he passed the examination for appointment as a junior mechanic in training. His work in the telegraph branch put him in contact with many involved in the new craze of radio and wireless. It did not take long for the bug to bite. He was a founding member of the preeminent Subiaco Radio Society, rubbing shoulders with the likes of Wally Coxon, VK6AG, Radio 6WF chief engineer until the PMG took over, and W.R. Phipps, VKCWP, chief engineer, Whitford's network. In February 1925, Harry was one of a handful of wireless experimenters who received the KDKA shortwave broadcasts to Australia. The following month, he commenced a regular series of lectures aired over 6WF and under the auspices of the Subiaco Radio Society, focused on shortwave work, but covering a wide range of radio topics. In May 1925, at a radio exhibition sponsored by the Subiaco Radio Society and the Wireless Institute, Harry Simmons was awarded first prize in a class for flexibility-constructed wireless sets.
Sundays, particularly during the hours when 3LO is not on the air, the amateur stations are tuned in on many receivers. It's argued, however, that those stations are exceeding their functions in carrying on a broadcast service, that their transmissions should be confined to experimental messages or items. That contention is reasonable enough, but it's extremely difficult to say that the transmission of mechanical music, gramophone records and player piano rolls does not constitute some form of experiment or test which comes rightly within the authorization of an experimental transmitter. The amateurs in every country had a fair share of the pioneering of broadcasting. In fact, we know in this country that it was the amateurs who introduced us to the new form of entertainment. In many cases, they no longer remained amateurs when broadcasting became a business, but there are still, and always will be, a large number of wireless enthusiasts and workers known by that rather unsatisfactory designation of amateurs. There is still a wide field for development in radio phenomena, and the more workers, competent workers, the better for all concerned. There are certain investigations, such as those affecting the problems of fading, of atmospheric and wave propagation generally, which need many workers scattered over wide areas. In those investigations, the cooperation of amateurs is essential and has been availed of very gladly and appreciated very warmly in America. In Australia also, we will need the cooperation of the amateurs in many directions. It's a good thing, therefore, to see that the clubs are not missing any opportunities of assisting listeners generally, as by holding exhibitions, as well as encouraging their own members to greater efforts for the welfare of wireless. I suppose that could have been a discussion we would have had in the present. However, this item was from the Daily News in Perth on the 19th of March, 1928.
On HF, VHF, and UHF, via the BK6 linked repeater network, and online, this is News West from BK6 ARN.
Transistors had been invented, but the syllabus of the course I was studying at Perth Technical College had not yet recognised that fact. Wally Peterson was employed as a part-time lecturer to take an extracurricular introductory subject on these newfangled devices. I attended. He was certainly enthusiastic about them, and we learnt a lot and saw working circuit examples. Junction transistors were the in thing, although point contact types were still being talked about. The college engineering department had purchased two small signal germanium transistors type OC70 at over £5 each for familiarisation. I was allowed to experiment with one, but in the process obviously did something wrong as it exploded, literally. I was left with three leads embedded in the base, with no sign of the rest of the device. No one has yet challenged my claim to be the first person in WA to blow up a transistor. Shortly, on the amateur front, the VHF group had to move their 6-metre beacon, which incidentally used an 807 output tube. Unattended operation was yet to be permitted, so it was relocated in Billy and Aileen Clough's garage in Subiaco, as they were both licensed amateurs. I don't know what the original keying arrangement was, but I suspect some sort of mechanical arrangement a la IFF sets. The price of transistors had come down to the extent that even amateurs could afford the occasional one. To demonstrate my newfound knowledge, I scraped the paint off an OC70 to make it into a photo detector. The code wire was made of stiff paper glued to the eddy current disc of a salvaged watt-hour meter, with the pressure coil activated normally, and the current coil carrying current from the 6.3-volt heater supplied to a dial lamp which provided illumination. It worked quite well until summer approached, the ambient temperature increased, and so did the germanium transistor leakage current, until the transmitter was effectively permanently keyed down. Wally House, VK6ZIA, fixed the problem by replacing the OC70 with an AWP photoresistor. More knowledge gained. The frequency capabilities of LED transistors restricted their use to audio applications, and their power dissipation ratings limited output power to a few watts. Transformer coupling, harking back to the early days of triodes, was the norm. Arthur Taylor of the Whitford Radio Broadcast Network built an outside broadcast amplifier which was housed in a Mills & Wares RAS showcase. I saw it once and thought it looked a bit rough and ready, but it must have worked, although I don't know if it met all the broadcast specifications. While I was working for WA Broadcasters, my construction of an OB amplifier had the sophistication of purpose-made plywood cabinet with sloping front panel and level meter, even a carrying handle. The main part of the amplifier consisted of two standard two-stage Class A amplifiers with OC74s in push-pull, feeding a standard Trimax 600 ohm to 600 ohm centre-tapped line transformer. The microphone preamp used a special, that is expensive, low-noise transistor, but even that only marginally met the broadcast noise specifications. Two Zener diodes to protect the output transistors against a magneto signal on the program line had to be specially ordered in. Power was provided by a pair of 509 Lanthan batteries in the bottom of the box. It was quite popular for jobs where only one microphone was required. It was light to carry and didn't need a messy power cable to be untangled. Jumping now into another transistor foray. The adoption of television receivers by much of the general community had resulted in a plentiful supply of burnt-out line-output transformers. The ferrite cores from these could be salvaged and used for various other purposes. Transistors capable of several amps that collect the current had become available, and my recycling exertions produced a number of DC to DC converters using these, with 12 volts input and about 300 volt output as needed for valve equipment. They were certainly an improvement on vibrators and genumotors. Charles Casino made the windings for me, which I then dipped in potting varnish left over from an unrelated project by Max Shooter, VK6ZDR. The power transistors for the oscillator were germanium, but the high-voltage diodes were the newly developed silicon type. Yet another foray. Germanium transistors were still all the vogue, and as their frequency capabilities gradually extended higher, I managed to get an OC170 to oscillate on 2 meters. Some crude modulation was achieved by placing a rocking armature earpiece in the collector feed. I expect there was more FM than AM, but whatever it was, VK6JO on the other side of the river was able to copy it. Hence another of my claims, to be the first person in WA to make contact using an all-solid-state transmitter. I'm just waiting for someone to refute that by saying they had done it half a century earlier using a spark transmitter.
With the escalating COVID scene in Western Australia at the moment, clubs will be resorting to on-air or online meetings. One of the services offered by the Radio Amateur Society of Australia, and it's offered free to clubs, is their fully paid-up Zoom account. All you need to do is to send an email to RASA asking to use Zoom, giving the club name, date and time required. It's as simple as that. No mucking around with free systems and their unknown limitations and surprising glitches. Send an email to info@vkradioamateurs.org. Did you get that? info@vkradioamateurs.org. I reckon one of the failings of amateur radio is brought about by our resourcefulness. It's because we're so good at scrounging and making do that we end up with resources that aren't entirely ours, or not ours at all. This has been evident over the years when it comes to sites for things like repeaters, and for some time now, amateur radio clubs and users have been using online resources, and these are often donated or even borrowed. And our backbone systems and sometimes websites fall over, probably because we don't have total control, let alone any ownership, of those resources. So what's the answer? Well, I don't really know. However, these days when companies are more conscious of their liabilities, the old carton of beer economy doesn't stand up anymore. Is it time for amateur radio to grow up? And I don't mean that unkindly. I mean it in the context of keeping up with modern business practice. Instead of borrowing or even usurping resources, should we be entering into some sort of formal agreement, providing for the needs and protection of both parties? By all means, make use of what's free, but at the same time, should second best and regular failures be the price of free? After posting my usual promotion for News West last week in a couple of Facebook groups, a serial pest congratulated me for not sledging the WIA for a change. For starters, I was pleased that he takes notice of what we say, but anyway, I responded in this way. I don't sledge the WIA, but I do sledge those individuals who exhibit poor behaviour, such as bullying and victimisation, claiming to be acting on behalf of the WIA. And some are in there, in the WIA. Right at the top, there's a difference between the organisation, of which I'm a member and for which I have fervent hopes of success, and those people who claim to be acting on its behalf. Such acts of bullying and victimisation and exclusion are commonplace. You only need to observe the actions of a few whenever RASA is mentioned or someone says something critical about the Wireless Institute. There are those who keep on claiming that the bad behaviour isn't happening. That itself is exhibiting the same poor behaviour. If someone says that they are being bullied or victimised, their concerns should be listened to and heard, not dismissed out of hand because they vote for the wrong team. I'm Bob VK6POP.
A good way to encourage someone's entry into the hobby is to acknowledge their achievement by welcoming them. Next weekend, News West does just that when we take a look at new amateurs. We'll congratulate those who have newly earned call signs, be it first-timers or upgrades and call sign changes. And on top of that, we'll present items to inform new hams and perhaps give the more elderly in the hobby something to think about and ideas of what you could get up to. What was your experience as a new ham? How about telling us your story of your entry into the hobby? We'd love to hear from you. If you're unsure of how to go about it, shout out on newswest@vk6.net.
Amateur Radio, you're standing in it. This is VK6, Amateur Radio News, and you're listening to News West.
Good morning once again. Yes, it's me, Roy Vay, with this week's helpline, the 20th of February 2022. Today I have brand new high gain DX88 vertical antenna covering 80 metres through to 10 metres, asking $300 for that. If you're interested, please contact Gavin. His call is on VK6 Victor Kilo Sierra, and his phone number 0428-388-531. 0428-388-531. Next item is another vertical antenna. It's a Wolf River Silver Bullet 1000 with radio kit and extension rods, a megapod, and also an MFJ1979 17-foot whip antenna, asking $450 for that. Collect from Wembley, and that comes from VK6 Kilo Charlie Kurt on 0414-500-959. 0414-500-959. And there's a picture of it on the email that I send out each week. And the next item I have for you is from Ali. It's a repeat from last week. An ICOM IC7410 HF 100-watt transceiver, $950. There's an ICOM IC7000 UHF VHF transceiver, $900. And a PowerTech power supply, $30 for that. Contact Ali on 0407-992-335. 0407-992-335. And that, my friends, is all I have for you, except have not heard if the QST magazines and the AR magazines have gone. If you're interested in that, please contact Andy, VK6 Oscar X-ray, 0448-028414. 0448-028414. That's me, done. X-ray Victor, VK6 X-ray Victor is the email address, VK6XRayVictor@bigpond.com. If you want to have any further correspondence to enter into, please contact me, and 7-3 till next time.
Thanks for listening, and thanks to the broadcasters and those who maintain the equipment that carries the news broadcasts. Thanks, of course, to the studio team and to our supporters. Next week, we focus on new amateurs, and I hope to see you at the PARG swap meet this Saturday coming at the Mandurah Bowling Club. Don't let your antenna droop in the heatwave. Keep it up and keep on getting on air and making some noise.